Hi, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is the Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of April 18th, 2014. On the show this week, how confident are you? Oh, and by the way, are you male or female? We talk to the authors of a new book that argues confidence is the key to women's success at work. Also, we'll help you hack the modern flying experience. Here's a hint, be nice. But we're going to start with some news about the thing you might be listening to us on, or checking while you're enjoying this show on your local public radio station, your smartphone. There's a lot to talk about, and we're joined by the host of Marketplace Tech, Ben Johnson. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Lizzie.
So, a lot of cell phone news this week, starting with Amazon. They are maybe coming out with their own phone?
This is the rumor. It's been rumored for a while. We saw some photos leaked online this week, supposedly. Of course, the photos, they look like a phone. It may come out at a company event in June. This follows, of course, their Fire TV, which they also released this year, which was sort of a long time coming, but also a piece of hardware made by Amazon entering kind of a crowded market. The phone would also be entering a very crowded market. Lots of companies are struggling to compete with, of course, Apple and Samsung, the big makers. So it's kind of interesting.
Right. So if it's such a crowded market, why do they want to get in it?
Well, the key to the future for a lot of companies like Amazon is still ecosystems. Whether you're a hardware company, software company, a company doing both, you want people in your ecosystem. And Samsung
is using all your products.
Using all of your products, but also all of your software, accessing all of the things that you sell in the case of Amazon. So you remember a little few weeks back, we all learned that we could now finally get Microsoft Word on our iPads, et cetera, et cetera. That was an example of Microsoft sort of like losing a battle, wanting to force people to buy the Surface tablet in order to use Microsoft Word and that kind of software. But they eventually had to give it up and let people use it because they still want people in their software ecosystem. This is another example that Amazon, you know, they want to be your everything. When you unlock your phone, when you open your phone up, Amazon wants you to go into Amazon first, whether you're buying groceries or toilet paper or television, whatever you might be wanting to get from your phone, Amazon wants to give it to you.
Wow. So I want to stick with the phone concept, though. We had some other phone news this week, which is the idea of a kill switch.
Yes.
Like you lose your phone in a taxi and what happens?
The kill switch. Yes. Yeah. So this is interesting. It's been a growing problem. I mean, look, there's been an explosion of mobile devices, right? We're all using more of them. Now we each have three of them, four of them, maybe. And of course, there's also been an explosion in the theft of mobile devices. This is a potentially lucrative form of theft. A thief can pull one of these things off you, maybe sell it for a street value. It's a huge problem, and it's been growing for a while. And a lot of lawmakers are talking about maybe putting forth legislation that would force companies to build some sort of kill switch into the phone or device that would make it stop working and make sure your data was safe.
Yeah, I mean, companies have been a little resistant to this.
Yeah.
Is the legislation idea what's pushing them to maybe get on board?
That's my sense. I think a lot of states have been talking about this legislation. Government officials have been talking about it. And what's basically happened is finally major manufacturers like, you know, HTC, Motorola, Samsung, Apple, and also the wireless carriers, your cell phone company, are also finally coming around to this and saying, all right, you know what? We have to do something about this. And that's the result. What's interesting is this sort of private answer from the private industry is that it has to be something that you opt into. And I think that while a lot of advocates for a kill switch feel good about that, they're also good about it in general. They're worried about the opt-in part of this.
That customers would have to know that they have to do it.
Yeah.
I guess on the other hand, on the company's point of view, it could be a selling point, right? We've got this extra thing. So maybe, hey, now they're down with it.
It could be. And you know, I think as long as a lot of people adopt it, it'll be something that's pretty regular from now on. Yeah.
Ben Johnson, host of Marketplace Tech. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Lizzie.
This is Marketplace Money from APM. We often talk about creating a budget on this show, figuring out your monthly income, expenses, what you want to set aside for retirement, emergencies, and, you know, fun. But if you don't have a lot of money coming in, the whole exercise can feel overwhelming, maybe even pointless. To be blunt, how do you budget when you're broke? That's what Kristen Wong wrote about for the website Lifehacker, where she's a personal finance blogger. Welcome to Marketplace Money.
Hi, thank you.
I think a lot of people might sit there and think, well, wait a minute, if I don't have a lot of money, does it matter if I actually put together a written down or online budget? What would you say to them?
Well, it is really hard because a lot of the traditional budgeting methods are like the 80-20 method, 60-30, 60-40, or whatever the numbers are. A lot of the traditional budgeting methods don't really work when you don't have a lot of money because, you know, you can barely afford to pay your bills. So how are you supposed to allocate a certain amount to your bills and a certain amount to this and that? What helped me when I was broke was focusing less on a budget and more of just a plan.
So let's back up. If you're in a situation where you don't have a lot of money coming in, what do you prioritize first?
The first thing, what I think a lot of personal finance experts kind of unanimously agree on, is that you should have an emergency fund. I mean, even when you have debts. And from my own experience, having an emergency fund was pretty crucial. You know, give yourself a little breathing room in your budget, because if you don't, you kind of risk blowing it. And then just focus on paying off the debts.
You mentioned your own situation. Tell me that story. What happened?
When I was in college, I had to pay for my own college. You know, I got some financial help. I took out a loan. But for the most part, I had to work a couple of jobs and pay for school and stuff like that. And when I finished school, I had student loan debt and I had a little bit of consumer debt. So I just really wanted, I had no money and I just really wanted to pay that off as quickly as possible. So I had a job at the time where I was making, you know, $10 an hour, just like my college job.
So what'd you do?
You know, everybody talks about Dave Ramsey's snowball method, and it works. And I think a lot of those, it's a universal personal finance tenet that kind of works. You know, there are certain things, live below your means. I set up an emergency fund. That was a huge lesson for me, because at first I was like, I'm just going to pay off these debts. I'm not going to budget any room for fun. And I'm going to just do it. And it just doesn't work realistically that way, because eventually you want to give in to eating out.
Temptation, or, whatever
yeah,
that is.
Or buying something that's not rice and beans or whatever, you know?
You wrote about two different ways to approach debt, one called the snowball method and one called the avalanche. Explain those to me.
The snowball method is kind of just based on your mindset. So you're paying off your smallest debts first, because we kind of wrote about this in the article about how when you set smaller milestones for yourself, it helps you achieve your greater goal faster and better. And I think that's kind of how the debt snowball method works. And then the other method is just the practical method, which is pay off the ones that have the highest interest rates. Because if you do the math on both of those, then the latter method is going to work, is going to save you the most money, because you're saving money on those interest rates. You're not paying the extra money in the interest.
You targeted this really toward young people, and there are some other things that are in here that I thought were really interesting, which were sort of ways to earn a little extra money, selling your stuff, finding a side gig, asking for a raise. What kind of feedback did you get from commenters when you put this article out there?
Anytime you put any kind of advice that can't apply to everybody, people are going to say, that doesn't apply to me. And I totally get that, because I do the same thing and I've done the same thing. What I've noticed the common thread is in these get out of debt, overcome my obstacles kind of stories, the common thread is that they take control of their financial situation. And that doesn't mean that they're like suddenly able to pay all of their bills and like somehow the money starts flowing in. It just means whatever their situation is, however unsettling their financial situation is, they vow to do something about it and stop saying, well, there's nothing I can do. And there might not be a lot of opportunities available, but I think that's all the more reason to focus on them than focus on what you can't do.
You also talk about the power of negotiating. Give me a couple of examples where people can negotiate some of their bills down.
I feel like I negotiate my bills every month. It's just sometimes they just increase for like the most inane or random reasons. And actually, an article I read recently was your car insurance, or any insurance, really, if you don't shop around, it's called price optimization. If you don't shop around, they actually charge you more because they know you're not keeping your options open.
Looking back now, sort of from where you are, mm-hmm. do you feel like you have control over your money?
Yes. And, you know, I was laid off last year, and that has always been my biggest fear, is I've been poor and I never want to go back to being poor again. And it terrifies me. And I used to be really driven by that fear. And I think that just goes back to just me being in control. And it was a really great feeling because I haven't always felt in control of my finances, and I don't feel in control of many things. So that was a pretty amazing feeling.
And yet it sounds like you were able to put together a tool that gives people some degree of agency, maybe, over their own finances?
I hope so. I hope so. And going back to the control thing, I mean, there's only so much a lot of these people can do, and it's such a struggle. But I think going back to those universal tenets of personal finance that have just been tried and true and work and proven to work, I think that is taking a step in the right direction of gaining control.
Kristen Wong is a personal finance blogger for Lifehacker. Thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you so much for having me.
Coming up, you've got $200,000 in student loan debt. Taking out a mortgage sounds nuts, right? Well, it depends on what you're going to make.
Best estimates for starting salary are anywhere between like $300,000 and $900,000.
That and much more coming up on Marketplace Money from APM. This is Marketplace Money from APM. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Now is the part of the show where we take your calls and answer some financial questions. And joining me for that today is Lauren Lyons-Cole. She is a personal finance expert. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
Our first caller is Telemachus in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. All right, did I butcher that or not?
No, you did very well. It's Telemachus.
Telemachus. Okay. All right, Telemachus. You're 31, is that right?
Correct.
And tell me a little bit about your financial situation. I gather that you are kind of a part of what we could broadly call a bit of the lost generation, right? You hit a rough part of kind of being underemployed, unemployed, but now you're back on your feet.
Right. Yeah. So I had a time period where I was underemployed and unemployed. Partially of my own doing after a long European vacation and coming back in that 2009 time period. So, but now I'm doing better and been maxing out my employee contribution, trying to get back on track with retirement savings and my emergency fund.
Okay, and about how much money do you make?
Between $50,000 and $60,000 a year.
So tell us what your main questions are.
Yeah, so my main question is, what can I do with my emergency fund that will return more than a dollar a month as a return on my investment? So right now it's just in a savings account. I have about $10,000 that I want to keep building just as that in case I end up in a no-job situation or some other catastrophe strikes. What can I do with that money that will have a better return for me?
Hearing you say that, you have clearly had the experience of someone who has been there before. So having that emergency fund is maybe got that more emotional importance to you than someone who's just doing it because they know they have to.
Yeah, I definitely want to have that. But at the same time, I want to do something with it. I was thinking about investing in stocks with it because I'd be able to liquidate it quickly if I needed. But at the same time, that might be too risky for the purpose of that money.
Lauren was making a little bit of a scrunched up face when you said stocks, so I'm going to turn you over to her. Here she goes.
Well, congrats, Telemachus, on that awesome sounding job. And the fact that you're also managing to build, I mean, $10,000 in savings is a huge amount, especially on a $50,000 to $60,000 a year salary. So anyone who's listening who thinks they can't save money, you're totally proving them wrong. So good job. Now,
thank you.
As you sort of pointed out yourself, you know, you need this emergency fund just in case something happens again. And ideally, you want to have at least 6 months of living expenses built up. And I always tell people that 10,000 is a good starting point, and then you can build from there. So that's a perfect goal. You get to the five digits and you feel good. But it is really important to keep that money somewhere safe. Like you mentioned, stocks, they might be a bit risky. And certainly in 2008, 2009, we saw that where you could just lose so much so quickly. And God forbid that happens. And then you're out of a job. So your $10,000 is down to $6,000 and you've got a lot less time to find a new job. So even though that small, tiny bit of interest doesn't feel very exciting, unfortunately, that's really the best thing to do with your emergency fund. One thing you might want to try, because you said, I believe that you're earning like $1 a month in interest, which is very, very low. So I'm going to guess that you are at a traditional bank with your savings account.
Yeah.
You are. Okay. I'm a huge fan of online savings accounts because those banks don't have overhead. They're able to pay you more in interest. It's still small, but on $10,000, you should be getting closer to like $10 a month rather than $1. So I personally like banks like Ally or even Capital One 360, Barclays, American Express. There are some banks online where you can get closer to 1% a month. So you might want to look into one of those.
That's an option I've considered, but then I wanted to reach out to the experts here on the radio and see if there was a more lucrative opportunity. But it's sounding like play it safe, stupid is the way to say.
Yeah, and really, I think if there's any cash you have that you think you're going to need within the next 5 years, so whether it's an emergency fund or a short-term vacation or even a home buying fund, you want to keep that out of the stock market because it's just too risky. But if we're looking at 5 years, 10 years, 30 years down the road, then we're going to start thinking about investments.
I know it's a little vanilla, but, you know, when you're talking about an emergency, you kind of want vanilla because it's comforting.
And it's safer that way.
I understand.
Thank you so much, Telemachus.
Thank you for your time.
All right, Lauren, our next caller is Christopher in Kansas City. Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Good. Do you go by Christopher or Chris?
I go by Chris.
All right, Chris. So you are a fourth-year medical student, right?
That is correct, yes.
You have a pretty healthy amount of debt, but you are also one of those people who knows you've got, I could also say, healthy income coming your way because you're going to specialize in neurosurgery.
Yeah. In the long term, I got about 7 years of residency where the money's not quite the attending salary. But in the long run, sort of the debt hopefully will be paid off.
So tell us how much debt you've got.
Currently, I'm sitting on about $215,000.
Okay, that would send most people screaming down the hall, but a neurosurgeon stands to make what?
Best estimates for starting salary are anywhere between like $300,000 and $900,000.
All right, so that puts it in a somewhat different perspective.
A little bit.
Yeah. Tell us about what your question is.
So my question is, I start my residency here coming up in July, and I will be in the same city for 7 years. So the thought occurred to me, why not buy a house? And so I'm investing in something as opposed to just renting and sort of giving that money away and not really building up any sort of ownership. So I started looking into loans, and they actually provide doctor loans specifically for mortgages or doctors coming into residency where you can get really good down payments with reasonable rates. So I was looking at a loan with a 0% down payment for $150,000 with an interest rate of, it was 3.25%. It was adjustable 5-1 year. Adjustable rate 5-1. So long story short, I decided to end up renting just because of my sort of cash on hand and not really having much disaster money at this point just because I'm coming fresh out of med school. But I guess my question is, would it have been a good idea to start investing in a home? And then from this point, is it a good idea to do this sort of loan next year, or should I just wait, build up some capital, get a more standard mortgage in the future?
Well, not only
are you going to talk with Lauren, who is a personal finance expert, but and she's actually blushing a little bit. She is engaged to a doctor, a resident, so she knows a little bit about this whole doctor loan situation. Lauren, what do you think?
Chris, I'm so excited to talk to you because I happen to know quite a bit about being a resident and being a doctor and the different little financial considerations that you guys have. So one thing is with the doctor loan, since you're going to be in residency for 7 years, I definitely think it's smart to be considering making a purchase in Kansas City. Have you ever been to Kansas City? I guess you interviewed there, but are you familiar with the place?
Yeah, I'm currently there for med school, so I've been here for 4 years. I'm pretty familiar with it, yeah.
Okay, so now that you're telling me these things, I'm definitely thinking that it could be worthwhile for you to go ahead and purchase something. The New York Times actually has a wonderful calculator that could tell you for sure whether or not this is the right choice for your situation. Google the New York Times buy versus rent calculator.
Okay.
You can put in all the details of your situation, and it'll help you decide whether or not it's worth it to make a purchase. Though my instinct is that it's going to be worth it, so you might want to start shopping online, especially if you have access to a little bit of cash to get this started, and you're going to be paying rent anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Keep in mind, you know, you don't have to do it right away. You could, like you mentioned, do it next year. You can also do it when you're done with residency, especially if you end up moving somewhere else. So there's no rush because these loans exist at any point. Any medical student or resident out there should be aware of these because it's a great benefit and it makes sense for the bank's perspective. Another thing, though, that I really want to mention for you, I don't know if you've considered this and you didn't exactly ask this, but with your student loan debt, you should definitely start paying on it as soon as possible. And any resident should do this if they're able to. Reason being, you can select pay-as-you-earn or income-based repayment. And if you haven't earned any money while you've been in medical school, your payment for the first year could very well be $0 each month. But it counts as a payment. And if you end up long-term, you know, you're going to be 7 years working at a hospital. If you end up working at a hospital after that, if you've got 10 years working in a hospital, you actually get the remaining balance of your loan forgiven through the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program.
Wow.
Incorporate that into your budgeting. Incorporate that into your thought process when you're looking for a home, what your mortgage, you know, monthly payment will be. You should definitely be paying on your loan while you're in residency.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
Take care. All right, Lauren, we are going to take a quick break. Will you stick around with us to take some more calls when we come back?
I'd be glad to.
This is Marketplace Money from APM. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. We are back with Lauren Lyons-Cole, personal finance expert, and we're going to take a call now from Sarah in San Francisco, California. Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
How are you?
Oh, I'm doing fine.
You're in a unique situation because you have, for any other place in the country, a pretty decent financial picture, but you happen to live in a very, very expensive city. Tell us about it.
So I came to San Francisco a little over a year ago, and I'm making a very good salary. I make $115,000 a year, which is way more than I ever anticipated making. And I have $25,000 in student loans. But anyway, I feel really crushed by the cost of rent here. And So I'm putting aside money for retirement and a rainy day savings account. I'm going to get married in July. And so my fiance and I are just trying to figure out how we're going to afford raising a family in this city.
First off, those student loans. You sort of said, but anyway, to those. What's the payment? What's the rate on those look like? How are you paying them? You feel okay on that front? Tell us about those.
Yeah, I do feel okay on that front. I have a smaller loan from my undergraduate studies, and that is at 1.7%. It's very low. And then my graduate school loan is a little bit bigger, but the interest rate on that is 6.7%. And so I'm paying that one off a little bit more aggressively. It's, I think they require me to pay about $300 or $350 a month, but I am paying close to $500 just to get them out of the way faster.
Okay. And you mentioned your fiancé. So before we even get to the housing situation, you've got a wedding coming up.
Yes.
How are you paying for that?
That is coming mostly just from our savings. We're having a very inexpensive wedding in Tahoe, so it's going to be an outdoor wedding, and our budget is $6,000 to $7,000. So, and I think we're going to be under budget. We're not really tied to any specific idea of how a wedding should be, and we really just want it to be a fun party for our friends. So we're spending money on the important things, and then we're, you know, using an iPod and things like that.
Congratulations. You're like the only person in America who managed to come in under budget on a wedding and focus on how to afford housing and how to pay your student loans. Now let's talk about housing. I've got Lauren here with me, and I suspect she's probably got some questions about the rent versus buy ideas and living in San Francisco. Lauren, take it away.
Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
Congratulations on your upcoming wedding, and huge congratulations for keeping it to such a tight budget. That's amazing.
Oh, thank you.
In regards to, you know, your concerns about housing, interestingly, you know, you said you make $115,000, and for people who don't live in a big city like New York or San Francisco, it's interesting to note that $115,000 is actually, like, by the New York City government, considered to be moderate income. So you can actually get subsidized housing if you live in New York City making that kind of income. That's the high. I think it ranges from like $91,000 to about $114,000, $115,000. So actually, that sounds like a big number, but it really doesn't go so far in a big city. So I completely understand. That said, you know, I feel like there's maybe a little bit more at play. I mean, clearly you're good with numbers. You know, you've got this huge amount of statistics experience in your background. So you understand that money is going to be tight. But it sounds to me like you might have some other concerns, or your student loans are under control. Your wedding's amazing. You know, you've got a pretty good place going in San Francisco for now. What do you really envision in the long term? What is it that's making you so kind of stressed out about this?
It's finding somewhere to raise a family. So, mm-hmm. you know, in the next few years, that's what we'd like to think about. And it just feels like there's no place we could ever afford to have a couple of kids, even if we revised our standard of living, you know, we no yard and maybe it's an apartment and everything like that. It still just feels mm-hmm. like we're going to be nickel and diming for a long time, even though we make a decent salary. I really like the job market here in San Francisco. I have a good career path for now. And so I'd like to stay, but then at the same time, it's just so tough with the renting market. And also, obviously, the home buying market.
You know, I like what you said about your wedding, that you guys don't have any preconceived notions about what a wedding is supposed to be like. And I think when it comes to purchasing a home and raising a family, I have a feeling you're going to take the same approach, which I think is a really good approach, especially in a big city. It gives you the ability to sort of think outside of the box and be creative, to stay focused on what your priorities are, especially if you like your job in San Francisco, you like the area. I mean, there are definitely places, and I always encourage people, if you're thinking about buying a home, do some online shopping. There is no harm in seeing what's out there, getting a feel for neighborhoods. You know, you can do this 3 years in advance just so that you know what kind of budget you're talking about, what kind of house is going to make you happy. Maybe you'll even get like a fixer-upper, or there might be some sort of thing that will occur to you along the way that'll make you feel a little bit more confident in your ability to achieve that dream.
I'm just curious, when you and your fiance talk about this, how do you picture raising a family together? What do you say?
It's actually always a little bit confusing when we talk about it because we're not really sure, because, you know, we look at our surroundings in San Francisco and think, well, maybe we should move to Berkeley, but we don't, you know, but even there, it's like very expensive. So, I mean, our main priorities are to be somewhere where we can easily go camping and things like that. And so we haven't really talked about the day-to-day life of having kids, except to talk about how it's going to be really hard to find housing.
Well, you're not going to find the sort of track housing or the subdivisions that you're going to find in other parts of the country. But, you know, if like for $650,000 out in Berkeley, I know you can get a pretty like a 3-bedroom house and maybe be walking distance to cafes and, you know, so even if your kids end up sharing a room or you're kind of on top of each other, that could be a really fun way to raise a family. So I think, you know, being comfortable with those sorts of solutions will go a long way as well.
Yeah, well, thanks so much for the advice. I really appreciate it.
All right, Sarah, thank you so, so much for calling us. Was this helpful at all?
Oh, no, it was really helpful. I listen to you guys all the time, and I just wanted something specific to New York City or San Francisco where there's very high rent, so I really appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely.
Okay, thanks so much.
All right, take care.
You too.
Thanks a lot. And Lauren, thank you so much for joining me. Lauren Lyons-Cole is a personal finance expert. Thank you so much.
Oh, it was a pleasure, as always.
Just ahead, why early failure might be the secret ingredient to turn girls into successful women.
Although we're raising girls in large measure these days to think they can do anything, no girl thinks she can't necessarily do something. Part of the problem is we're still nurturing them to be perfect and people pleasers and well-behaved. In fact, too perfect.
Coming up on Marketplace Money from APM. This is Marketplace Money from APM. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Women in the workforce get no shortage of messages about how we should behave. Advocate for yourself, but not too much. Ask for a raise, but pick your moment. It can feel like a minefield. Two longtime journalists have written a new book arguing that women will occupy more C-suites and positions of power by taking risks, speaking up, and being more confident. It's called The Confidence Code. Its authors are Caddy Kay, the anchor of BBC World News America, and Claire Shipman, a correspondent for ABC and Good Morning America. Welcome to you both.
Hi, Lizzie.
Thank you. Wonderful to be here.
First off, I want to understand what you two both mean when you use the word confidence.
We thought we knew what we meant when we set out to figure it all out. And we discovered after talking to a lot of psychologists and researchers that we actually didn't know. So here's our definition, the stuff that turns thoughts into action. We had to tease confidence apart from self-esteem, self-efficacy, but really confidence is about your belief in your ability to have an impact on the world, to get things done. So there's a real element of action about it.
The title of this book is The Confidence Code, but you also have talked about the confidence gap. And I'm going to take a little bit of an issue with you. I'm not sure you've made the case for me that there is a confidence gap between men and women. Lay it out for me. Where do you think that gap falls?
The last book we wrote made the case for women in business and how companies, organizations that employ more senior women do better than their competitors. And yet, as we interviewed these senior women, we kept hearing phrases like, you know, I'm just lucky to have got where I am, or I was in the right place at the right time, or I'm not sure I'm the right person for that new promotion or that new big contract. And we thought that's so strange. You know, we never hear phrases like that from men. So we started to dig into the research on this. And a lot of psychologists and business schools have now done research showing that there is indeed a confidence gap between men and women. For example, there's a business school study from Manchester University in the UK that the professor has been asking students, what do you think you deserve to earn 5 years after you graduate? Men routinely say they deserve to earn $80,000 on average. Women will say it's $64,000. That's a 20% difference. Hewlett-Packard, women will apply for promotions when they have 100% of the skill set. Men are happy if they have 60% of the skill set because they think they're going to learn the rest on the job. Women, whilst we have all the talent, we have all the competence, we're perfectly able, we are undervaluing ourselves compared to men.
I was very interested in the part of your book about failure and early failure. Explain to me why that is so important in building confidence.
This was revolutionary for both of us, I think, because we
hate failing.
We hate failing.
Oh, I love it. I think it's great.
But I know. And now
and
we
look what
we
you've
know,
learned.
Look what you've learned. But also, we're raising girls. And so it's really given us a new lens through which to watch the way we are doing that. And Carol Dweck said to us something that was pivotal. She said, if life were one long grade school, women would rule the world. And that is because although we're raising girls in large measure these days to think they can do anything, we're still nurturing them to be perfect and people pleasers and well-behaved, in fact, too perfect. And so they internalize this sort of coloring within the lines, pleasing people, being quiet, getting good grades. They do that all the way through college. They excel. They hit the real world. And guess what? They haven't screwed up. They haven't failed. They haven't learned that, you know, you lose, you flunk, you do this. It doesn't matter. You just keep going. And they've got to get dirtier with failure somehow.
You know, it's so interesting, Lizzie, you've talked about the fact that you've had failures in your life.
Yeah.
You've taken our confidence quiz and you've come out on the top end of the scale. And I bet you, I am willing to bet you that there is a correlation between those two things. Because what do you learn when you fail at something? Whether it's something small, like asking for a pay raise that you don't get, big or small, whether it's in your personal life or your private life, in the end, you realize you're still there. You're still standing.
The flip side of pushing women to be confident and take risk, of course, is what can happen to women in the workplace if you do that. I remember being a young reporter and having broken a story, and that story was given to a male reporter to stand out in front of the White House and read. And I fought like hell for it, and I was told that I was acting like a barroom brawler.
You know, this, I mean, look, we know, and when women behave exactly the same way as men do in the workplace, we get penalized for it. And while we were doing the research for the book, we kept coming back to this question, do you have to be a jerk to be confident? It was Christine Lagarde, actually, the head of the IMF, who made us tackle this issue because she is somebody, perhaps the most confident woman we know, but she listens to other people's opinions. She's very warm. She builds consensus. What we realized is she's very authentic to who she is. And I think part of being confident for women is being authentic to who we are. During the 1980s, we wore those hideous shoulder pads and the little string ties. And hey, you know what? It wasn't such a good look and it didn't work so well for us.
Katty Kay and Claire Shipman are the authors of The Confidence Code. Thank you both so much.
Thanks, Lizzie.
Thank you.
Turning from women at work to work in general, you know those lists of best places to work or coolest companies? Sometimes those articles focus on salaries or stock options or perks like wellness programs or a great cafeteria. But even those details sometimes don't tell you what the culture is like inside a company, what employees' lives are like. We asked Jason Seiden to come on the show. He's the CEO of Ajax Workforce Marketing, and he looked at the LinkedIn profiles of 250 people who worked at celebrated companies, and he found that 80% of them had nothing to say about the places they worked. Hi, Jason. Thanks for coming on.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Why did you decide to look into this question of why employees maybe weren't talking about why their companies were so great to work for?
It's interesting. I've been watching this trend on social media where employees are out there, they're looking each other up, they're engaging online the same way we would engage at a bar. You know, hey, what's real? What's going on? And what I didn't see was I didn't see companies adapting to that. I saw them using the same old broadcast channels to get their message out. So that disconnect was what I wanted to explore.
Can you explain to me what you mean by broadcast?
Yeah. So once upon a time, if a company wanted to speak to the world, they would have to buy advertising, right? Or they'd have to have a press release picked up by journalists and carried out through a broadcast medium. Now, because of social media, we all broadcast. And as consumers of media, we can opt to listen in or not to what's coming at us. And as soon as the consumer has that ability to choose, if you're not offering me something of value, I can tune you out. That never used to exist back when we were growing up. You had a half a dozen TV stations, and then cable came, and eventually the internet came, and it gave people a little bit of flexibility. I could either go to your website or not. But now with social media, I don't have to listen to you at all. I can actually engage back. I can reach back out to you, engage you in a conversation. And if I don't like the way that you engage with me, we're just done.
What happens here? You know, you get a list, 25 best companies to work for. Let's say I'm looking for a job. How do I filter through all this stuff and find kind of the best reflection of what a company's like to work for?
So it's interesting. You know, the process that I would use is the same process that I might use to figure out what movie I'm going to watch on a Saturday night. And yes, I know the stakes are higher when you're talking about where you're going to work, but the process is much the same. You know, I might know of a movie because it was on a list, like, you know, the Academy Award-winning movies, which is going to give me some indication that that movie gets something right. But then the next thing I'm going to do is I'm going to call up friends and I'm going to look at experts who, you know, critics whose opinions tend to reflect my own. And I'm going to get an opinion from those sources that hits a little bit closer to home. And so for job seekers who want to sift through the noise online, I recommend a similar process. You can look at these lists. You can look at what's coming through media about companies and say, oh, you know what? That company seems to be getting some stuff right. I'll put it on my short list of companies to investigate. And then when you want to investigate them, go to Glassdoor. See what real employees are saying. Go onto LinkedIn. See how employees are actually representing themselves. How many of those employees are loving their work enough to make the company's message part of their own? Go onto Facebook and post a note. Hey, I'm looking at Company X. Who do we know in our network who works there who can give me an inside story? It's that easy now to do your due diligence and get that inside scoop on what a company is really going to be like.
Of course, there's always the idea that there are jerks on the internet, right? Someplace might be a great company to work for, but what if the social media voice you're hearing is 1 to 10 disgruntled employees who aren't reflective of a broader workforce?
That is often the case. And when the company says, look, we're going to create one message and we're going to push this message out through radio, through TV, through print, through the web, they have to make sure that they have a perfectly constructed message. And the process of controlling that message is going to alienate a lot of people. There are going to be folks in that organization who have something to say who won't have a voice in that controlled process. And some of those people will be disgruntled. Some of them will be actually quite passionate about the company. They just, for whatever reason, the company has chosen not to make them part of the broadcast process. Those are the people who have turned to social media and have started to represent the organizations they work for. So, yes, there's disgruntled people. We all know that. But there's also passionate people who don't quite have the message. I think it's a mistake to assume that when we go online, we're going to be duped by disgruntled employees. When I work with employees and I work with consumers of information, they tend to be pretty savvy. They know that there's going to be voices out there who are unhappy.
Are there any keywords that you think people should sort of like focus in on when they see them?
Oh, I love that question. Whether we're talking about an individual or we're talking about a company, in our race to separate ourselves from the pack, we end up commoditizing ourselves so we all sound the same. You think about how most people talk about themselves as professionals. I'm a passionate, innovative problem solver with X number of years experience building high-functioning, dynamic
teams.
That's
just gobbledygook.
Right. I mean, like, you look, I don't even have to see you to know your eyes glazed over when I started saying that, right? So what you're looking for is you're looking for language that's real, that has an emotional quality. You don't have to look for it because you'll read it. It's like reading Hemingway or a great author. It's not that the words on the page are important. It's that contextually, you look at them, you're like, oh, you know what? I feel something. I know who this person is. I have a sense for what this company is. So that feeling that you're looking for, it's nothing that's going to get captured in keywords. Focus on the feeling you get when you're reading about this organization.
Jason Seiden is the CEO of Ajax Workforce Marketing. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
This is Marketplace Money from APM. Maybe you're starting to think about making summer travel plans, and all that stands between you and a nice walk on the beach is an expensive plane ticket, plus a fee to check your bag, another one to buy some food, an uncomfortable middle seat, having your knees mashed against a tray table, or your back pummeled by a small child's feet. But we promise, it pays to be nice. And so, we end today's show with a plea for in-flight politeness.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome aboard flight 2998, bound for Atlanta, Georgia.
My name's George Hobica, and I'm the founder of a website called airfarewatchdog.com, which is a low airfare advice and listing site. Flight attendants have a really tough job. They're very underappreciated. A lot of people think they're just trolley dollies, they call them, and people who, serve you a meal. They're really there for your safety.
There's no reason to become alarmed, and we hope you enjoy the rest of your flight. By the way, is there anyone on board who knows how to fly a plane?
With all the cost cuts that have gone on in the airline industry, their job has really gotten even more difficult. So I wrote this article, How to Make Your Flight Attendant Like You. And I've actually been testing some of the principles, and they really do work.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening to you.
Would either of you like a drink before we take off?
Yes, we would like one of your finest champagnes.
Certainly.
Being nice to a flight attendant starts the minute you get on the plane. Most flight attendants are trained to say hello, good morning, and most passengers don't say anything back. Then there's putting stuff in the overhead bins. That is the most stressful part of the flight for most flight attendants. Put the suitcase's wheels in. You don't want to put the suitcase so that it's parallel to the plane.
The overhead bins are closed and the cabin is secure.
Good job. I'll do the safety. You go tell the captain we're ready.
Okay.
Listen to the safety demo. It's so rude, in my opinion, not to listen to the safety demo. And the fact is that most people have not listened to that safety demo in 20 years. Every single time I fly, I pay attention to the safety demo. Even if I'm not really paying attention, I pretend to be paying attention. Take your headphones off, for goodness sake. That's one of the things that probably annoys flight attendants the most, having to repeat over and over, what would you like? And people say, huh? Huh?
What did he say?
Oh, he was just saying that we're going to be leaving in a couple seconds, so put your seatbelts on and make sure they're tight.
And then, of course, there are little things you can do. Like, a lot of people don't realize that flight attendants run out of pens because everyone is asking for a pen to do the crossword puzzle in the magazine or to fill out immigration forms. So if you happen to have some extra pens, I was in the American Airlines lounge not too long ago, and they were giving out pens. And I gave it to the flight attendant, and she said, you are a favorite passenger. Another way to help your flight attendant, if you happen to be a law enforcement officer, a paramedic, or a doctor, let the flight attendant know, because they never know what's going to be happening on the flight if there's an emergency. So that really will give them an upper hand in case there's an unruly passenger or a medical emergency.
I'm sorry I had to wake you. I'm just looking for a doctor. There's nothing to worry about.
Stewardess, I think the man sitting next to me is a doctor.
And if a flight attendant is really good to you, there are all kinds of ways to let the airline know that somebody has been given extra special service, and that does make a huge difference. I think if you're nice to your flight attendants, they're going to be extra nice to you. And I've actually been upgraded from economy class to first class once or twice in my life, I think just because I was nice to a flight attendant. I've been given bottles of wine at the end of the flight because I was nice to a flight attendant. You might get your drink served faster or your meal selection if you happen to have a meal on the plane. You might get the meal selection you wanted.
Chicken or beef stroganoff?
I'm out of chicken. I like the way that smells.
Oh, that was our last chicken. I'm afraid I just have stroganoff.
So why would you ask me what I wanted?
But it's just nice to be nice to flight attendants because it makes the whole flight experience less stressful.
Come fly with me. Come fly. Fly away.
George Hobica is the founder of airfarewatchdog.com. You can find more of his travel tips and a link to the article, How to Make Your Flight Attendant Like You, on our website, marketplacemoney.org. That's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, Liz Weston joins me to answer your money questions. Marketplace Money is produced by Candace Manriquez, Raghu Manavalan, and Lindsay Foster Thomas. A very special thanks to Lindsay, who is leaving us this week for Marketplace's Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our senior producer is Dan Semitovich. Charlton Thorpe is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Remember to always check with your financial professional before you make any big money decisions. And thanks for listening. This is APM.